Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
On today's podcast, we're excited to bring you part one of a lively conversation between best-selling author and philosopher of science, Stephen Meyer, and Oxford mathematician and all-around brilliant thinker, John Lennox. They got together recently to discuss Lennox's new documentary, Against the Tide, Finding God in an Age of Science. You can find out more about that at againstthetide.movie. Now, let's join the conversation.
It's great to have you with us. We understand that you have a new movie coming out, which is a bit of a departure for you. You have so many excellent books. In fact, first of all, maybe you should tell us about your new book on artificial intelligence.
My new book is called 2084. It's a takeoff from George Orwell, and it's really quite amusing because the title was suggested by none other than Peter Atkins, the famous atheist professor of chemistry at Oxford. We were going to a debate, which is online actually, where he was very opposed to me, but in the car, he said, "We're not going to talk about the debate. What are you writing?" So I told him, and he said, "I've got a title for you." I said, "What's that?" He said, 2084. Well, I said, "Peter, that's brilliant. If I use it, I will acknowledge you." And I've done that.
Excellent. I've had a very spirited debate with Peter myself on your BBC Radio 4 at one point, but that's terrific. So even our opposite numbers can be can add something to our work. So that's great.
Absolutely, because it just captured the spirit of what I wanted to do, talk about both the AI that's working at the moment, narrow AI, its pros and cons, and to try to get people to see that they don't have to be afraid of everything, but there are huge ethical issues. And then to talk about this more speculative stuff, artificial general intelligence. So I'm very pleased to see that there's been a huge response around the world in terms of interest, and I've done dozens of Zoom calls and interviews about it.
That's terrific, John. So you can see the promise of AI as a technology without buying into the materialist metaphysical program saying that the machine is conscious and that the human mind becomes unnecessary. Is that?
Well, that's absolutely right. And I want to encourage young people who are scientifically gifted, particularly if they're Christians, to go into this field so that, A, they can contribute some of the wonderful stuff that's being done in medicine, like the work of Rosalind Picard at MIT, but also can give folks insight into the ethical issues, for example, that surround surveillance technology.
Very good. That's a real concern, for sure. Well, we're promoting this, and we'll be promoting it more on our Mind Matters website here at Discovery Institute. But let's shift gears back to the primary reason for our conversation with John this morning. We want to give our subscribers and viewers and supporters and followers a heads up on a really fantastic film that's coming out. It's a little bit of a departure for John. He writes technical papers in mathematics. He writes books about science and faith. But now he's become something of a film star, working with none other than Kevin Sorbo, the actor who played Hercules. John's always been a bit of an intellectual superhero for all of us, but now he's actually teamed up with a real superhero. And I can tell you the conversations between the two of them are quite interesting. Kevin's quite up to date on these issues and about science and what it has to tell us about larger worldview stuff. So let's dive in there, John, and just with that introduction, maybe have you give us a little a background first on yourself, your career in math and in science, and how you've related that to your personal faith in God, because I know that you are a believer, and so maybe a little background on yourself, and then we'll segue from there into a discussion of the film and your life story and the way it tells that.
Fine. Well, I come from a very tiny country called Northern Ireland. And it's been made famous by people like C.S. Lewis. But unfortunately, it's rather infamous for sectarian violence. And I grew up when that was just starting. And some of the seminal influences on me when I was very young came naturally from my parents, who were keen Christian believers, but were very unusual because they were not sectarian. And my father ran a store, and he employed around 40 people, I suppose. And he employed people from both communities, the Protestant and the Catholic community, and he got bombed for it. And my brother was nearly killed by one of these bombs. And I once asked him, "Dad, why do you take the risk?" He said, "For this reason, that we learn from the Bible this fundamental mandate for civilization, that all human beings have the dignity of being made in the image of God." And he said, "I'm determined to treat them like that, irrespective of what they believe." And that became an absolutely fundamental principle for me throughout my life, the respect for people, even if you violently disagree with them, like Peter Atkins, whom I've mentioned. The second thing is, they loved me enough to give me space to think. Not only that, they encouraged me to think about the Christian worldview, but also about other worldviews, and encouraged me to read very widely, so that when I came up to university, I'd read not only of Christian arguments defending intellectually the veracity of the Christian faith, but I'd read quite a bit of philosophy and quite a lot of the opposition. So coming to Cambridge in the early in 1962, I, in a sense, hit the ground running because I've read a great deal of stuff. And the basic conviction I had was Christianity is true, not simply helpful or emotionally supporting, but actually true. And therefore, my mathematics and my interest in science and philosophy are seen against the wider worldview picture of Christianity. And I learned very early on, even at school, that the two fitted together, because I came across books on science and religion in the last few years of my high school. And so I was reading this kind of stuff. And it's interesting, Robert E.D. Clark, nobody's ever heard of him these days.
I have some of his old books, yeah.
Yes, well, I knew him in Cambridge, and I'd read his books, and they helped me to see that there were serious problems with the atheistic interpretation of the universe and with neo-Darwinism and so on. So he put me on an intellectual track, I nearly said, from which I never recovered.
You never did. Now, if you came up to Cambridge in 62, then you would have overlapped with C.S. Lewis in the last year of his professorship before he died. Did you ever encounter him there?
I did indeed, yes. I had read a great deal of Lewis. I owe him an immense intellectual debt because I have no idea what it's like to be an adult and an atheist, but he had. And I needed some kind of mature guidance into what does it feel like to be in an atheist's shoes. And Lewis guided me also, although he was no mathematician. In fact, we nearly didn't have C.S. Lewis because of my field of algebra, because he failed his first attempt to pass the Oxford entrance exam in algebra, and the war saved him from having to resit it. And I dread to think that we might not have had Lewis because of algebra. But he had a brilliant mind, and he understood not so much science, but the implications of science. And that was a huge education to me from the humanities side, for which I am really indebted. And realizing he was there, but not knowing that he was very ill, I looked him up in the lecture list, and so he was lecturing in the lecture rooms just within 1 minute walk of the mathematics department in Mill Lane. And so I turned up and listened to him lecture for two or three of what turned out to be the last lectures he ever gave.
That's quite a legacy. I know you and I have both been influenced by Lewis's writing about the laws of nature. He has a wonderful little essay.
That's right.
You know, published in God in the Dock. And then of course his writing in Miracles, and he has a brilliant exposition of why the laws of nature don't actually cause things. They describe patterns that we observe, but they're not the causes of things. And that's
it's immensely important. And what amazes me, Steve, is that there are very clever people. They don't seem to understand that. So the late Stephen Hawking never seemed to grasp that.
It runs right through all his work in what's now called quantum cosmology, the idea that the laws of physics can somehow explain the origin of the universe by offering a causal explanation for matter, time, and energy. But math doesn't do that. The laws of physics are written in math. Math describes the matter and energy within the universe once it's here, but it doesn't tell us where it came from. And
it's like saying that Newton's laws of motion cause a snooker ball to go across a table, which
exactly,
is absurd.
Exactly.
It describes the motion, doesn't cause it.
Or it'd be like saying that the latitude and longitude lines on the map are responsible for the great height of the Himalayan mountains or something. It's not quite the same
category. That's quite a good analogy, actually.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to the film itself. The title is really intriguing. It's Against the Tide. Give us what is the tide that your life has been running against in the sense the film is describing?
Well, I think it's essentially the tide of atheism, naturalism, materialism. It's a worldview tide, and it mm-hmm. ebbs and flows
right.
and goes in and out. But I find myself for most of my life in the academy, which is largely, in the West at least, dominated by naturalism. And I determined from the beginning that I would fight against that, not by compromising mathematics or even science, but by asserting them. And it's one of the great encouragements of my life to have lived long enough to have read books like Thomas Nagel's Mind and Cosmos, where he points out that the naturalistic interpretation of the universe risks actually demolishing human rationality and our use of it in science, which is an argument, as you well know, that Lewis foresaw. And that kind of thing confirms my stand, and it's similar to your own stand in the academic world. It's just important.
Yeah, it's a very exciting time to be a theist and a scientist and a philosopher. There's so many intellectual trends that are now moving against that tide that's been so dominant for so long. What was it like in the 1960s? And so we've had this, let me preface this question, we've had this publishing genre since about 2006, 2007, when Richard Dawkins came out with the God Delusion, and then there's been this spate of new atheist books, as they're called, right up to 2016, 17. I think Stephen Hawking even got in the act near the end of his career with books that were making these kinds of arguments, arguing that science properly understood undermines any rational basis for belief in God. This has been a more aggressive sort of scientific atheist polemic. But as you mentioned, this naturalistic worldview that has been around for longer than just the new atheism. And I wonder what it was like for you in the 1960s and 70s when you were starting out in your academic career. Was the atheistic tide as strong or as aggressive as it has become in the last few years with the new atheism, or was it more of a subtle undercurrent?
I think it was more of an undercurrent. And ironically, a lot of it in my early days at Cambridge was coming from inside professing Christianity in the honest to God debate and that kind of thing, so that many students were raising these questions, but it was more from the perspective, look, can we believe anything that Christianity claims? But there was still quite a lot of interest being generated. The arguments that I mentioned of R.E.D. Clarke were of interest to people. There were lectures being held and so on. And I remember going to listen to people like John Polkinghorne in those early days, giving a rational defense of Christianity. Let's put it this way. There was great interest in rational defense of the Christian faith. It wasn't so much in the science religion area, But in the wider sense of rationality, and of course, we weren't crippled in those days by the prevalence of scientism, which holds that science is the only way to truth. At least people felt that history and philosophy were rational disciplines,
right,
and
right.
could be taken seriously.
So you were encountering the undercurrent of naturalistic thinking or materialistic thinking as much in the religious community as in the wider academic community. In other words, liberal theologians who were denying the possibility of miracles, Christian theologians who were denying the resurrection, or Jewish theologians denying the Exodus, or whatever. That was part of how you were encountering this underlying assumption that the material world is all that really exists, and nothing could exist.
That's right. And the interesting thing is, what prepared me to encounter it is that in the 1940s and 50s, Lewis saw this very clearly. You mentioned his book on miracles. It is a brilliant refutation of naturalism. It's almost as if Lewis saw it was going to happen. And The Abolition of Man was a book that influenced me greatly, where he talks about this subtle way in which naturalistic worldview can be communicated even in an English textbook.
Right.
And it was creeping its way into the fabric of the academy. And having read those things, even as a schoolboy, I was certainly at a bit of an advantage when it came to entering the fray, which I did from the word go, actually.
You couldn't help yourself, John. It was built into the fabric of your being. So let's bring this up to date, because what was a subtle undercurrent or a kind of tacit presupposition among most academics has become much more explicit and aggressive with the advent of the new atheism, and with writers and scientists like Richard Dawkins, Lawrence Krauss, Peter Atkin, several of whom, of these folks, you and I have
encountered,
had interesting conversations with. Tell us a little bit about your encounters with this more aggressive form of scientific atheism.
Well, for me, it was almost a quantum leap. I had several encounters at a much lower level, but things changed about a dozen years ago when it was Larry Taunton of the Fixed Point Foundation suggested to both Dawkins and myself that they'd like to hear a bit of the Oxford debate, as he called it, in Alabama. Of all places.
Yeah.
It's a great place. I love being there. But that encounter with Dawkins, which was really formidable, almost overnight gave me a worldwide platform, which I've managed to retain. And the aggression, which I discovered doesn't characterize all atheists. I learned very rapidly that there's still some of the more old-style atheists who take the view that they respect but disagree with what I believe, whereas the aggressive stew style is, we don't respect what you believe, and we will mock it and ridicule it and all this kind of thing, which to my mind, as an academic, that means you've lost the argument before
right,
you start.
Right, right. Yeah, that's interesting. For our viewers, that debate is definitely worth a look if you haven't seen it. It's online.
And there are bits of it in the film.
Exactly.
The film actually refers to several of those debates as part of
some of the spicier encounters in that exchange. Yeah, but we haven't mentioned this, but for people who don't know John's current position, he is a professor of mathematics at Oxford, and he's a fellow of the Green Templeton College in the philosophy of science. So he's both a mathematician and a philosopher. So his encounters with Dawkins were, in a way, poetically just two Oxford professors of diametrically opposed worldviews discussing the big question, and especially the central question about the reality of God and what science can tell us about that. From my point of view, I thought John did very well in the debate. But, you know, we also very much appreciate, I do, these, in some ways, the new atheists are a different breed of scholar advancing a naturalistic or materialistic worldview. But there's something to appreciate about them. They have a gift for clarity in defining issues. Dawkins has been brilliant at that from his very first writing. His book, The Blind Watchmaker, began with on the first page with the central issue in biology. Biology is a study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. And he defined the issue right there. It's the appearance of design or real design. In some ways, the intelligent design movement owes its origin to the clarity with which Dawkins defined that issue. So I've always appreciated them in another way. I mean, they're aggressive and they come right at you when you're in discussion. But they raise the central issues and they do it in a way that brings clarity as to what they're about. And I thought you handled it beautifully in making the opposite case. And so there's some of that in the film, then, your encounters with
Oh, yes, there's some of that in the film, because that was something that interested Kevin Sorbo. Now, by the way, not as Hercules, but it is right.
Just as himself.
You were right to say that he's shown great interest and understanding of the things. And it was wonderful to get to know him, because I immensely enjoyed that interaction. And yes, we talked about the debates and went to where they were held and all this kind of stuff.
That was part one of a conversation between philosopher of science Stephen Meyer and British mathematician and thinker John Lennox. To learn more about the movie premiere November 19th, go online to againstthetide.movie. That's againstthetide.movie.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.